Welcome, welcome, welcome. Excited to have our current guest, and that's Steve Santangelo, independent analyst, energy market specialist, and also costs in relating to mining, which has so much to do with energies and precious metals. Steve, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today to have a chat.
Yeah, Francis, thanks for inviting me. And we've got a very interesting market, and it is plenty to talk about. Always plenty to talk about.
You've also seen some amazing charts, Steve. So I'll be sort of doing the driving. You tell me which ones and where you want to start, and as and when. But just sketch out as I suppose a nice loosener question for you: where are we right now? What's going down? How would you paint the scene in terms of macro energy?
Well, we hit the first big spike in oil in 2006 to 8. Right, we hit 147. Yeah. And that was kind of due to the peak of conventional oil. And then we had the QE and the Fed and the central banks come in and the Treasury to backstop the global financial crisis. And then we started to bring on more unconventional, like shale oil and oil sands. And so then we hit $100 oil. And now we hit the second kind of energy crisis. And the reason why, Francis, that was focused in Europe, because Europe is the largest net importer of natural gas in the world. If you look at the regions of about 60 billion cubic feet a day of net imports, Europe is number one at 35, and Asia comes in about 25. And then everybody else is exporting natural gas. So when you had some issues, supply issues, you know, with natural gas, it wasn't, you know, a coincidence that Europe was the canary in the coal mine. So now it looked dire, right, for Europe, but then we had actually the best scenario happened for Europe into the winter and now spring. They had a very warm winter. Green energy actually outperformed the year before it didn't, and then they really cut back on demand. And they got a lot of natural gas from LNG in the United States to offset the loss in Russia. So now they're looking at massive inventories compared to where they were the year before and the five-year average. And this is why we're seeing a current weakness. So going forward, I think we're in this lull phase now, even though we had these oil cuts from Saudi Arabia and OPEC. But the dynamics playing out kind of are with the central banks and the Fed, what they're going to do. But even if we see weaker prices in energy going forward, I think we got a massive push in energy coming in the next year or so. And so that's basically where we're at right now.
Yeah, so possibly some short-term weakness, but in the long run, on the macro, commodity is the bull. So we're gonna have a bit of the stag, which is the contraction in growth, and then we're gonna go back to the inflationary part. Is the macro sketch that you would outlay for energies?
Yeah, and the reason why I say that, Francis, has to do with the inability for the global oil industry to bring on a lot more supply. We did that since the global financial crisis. We brought on 12.5 billion barrels a day of supply, but we don't have that capability. So there's going to be a lot more competition for this oil, for the energy, and even the natural gas. But right now, the natural gas has gone in very volatile, and now we're going to see, we may see even weaker prices. That sounds crazy. But yeah, that's where we're at right now with the energy markets.
Yeah. And the feed in to mining. So obviously, big amount of energy costs in digging a massive hole deep underground. In South Africa, we've gone 2 kilometers underground. I'm not sure most other nations don't have to go that far, but they will in time. Break up all that rock, bring it all up and refine it. That's an energy process, isn't it? So explain to everybody the gearing that the move in energies back up and the pressure that's brought on the miners. And maybe is that the reason why miners are lagging, because they've had a lot of that cost coming up underneath them, strangling their margins, trying to keep that nose above water. And at the same time, it's taken a while for pricing to rise in the metals. And also some of them have forward sold delivery in futures and contracts. Is that part and parcel why miners are lagging? What's the outlook for miners given the energy scenario?
Yeah, Francis, you said it in a nutshell. And it's so funny. If you go back about 2,000 years, it cost a lot of energy to produce gold and silver and iron and copper. During the Roman Empire, they cut down forests and that was all wood. And so today we're using oil, natural gas, coal, a lot of electricity. And so the difference this time around, is that we had the high natural gas prices. We did not have that a decade ago. We had high oil prices. We didn't have high natural gas prices. So that feeds into the electricity, which it takes to mill the ore. And then, of course, the problem with the supply chains, a lot of equipment, a lot of mining equipment, a lot of materials really went up. And then the cost to pay for labor has increased. And so, yes, we have lower ore grades. And here's the amazing thing. Let's say you're producing the same amount of gold as a year, the same ore grade. The problem is a lot of these mines are getting deeper and deeper. And if you're going to put a 400 ton haul truck and it goes deeper, you're going to burn more fuel, even if it's the same amount of ore or the same ore grade. So we're seeing more diesel being consumed, and this is all about the energy. And that's why you're correct. The miners have not really performed like they did a decade ago. And so this is a struggle they're going to have going forward. But I still think there's plenty of room for, I think we're going to see a lot of people move into the miners into the future, because maybe a lot of other stocks and sectors will not perform as well.
Absolutely. It does sound like the only cure for that is prices, because you're getting decreasing ore quality. You're having to go much deeper for less good quality, and you've got increasing energy costs going further down under the ground, bringing it back up. And then you've got all the ESG, which I'm sure you'll get into or express a view on, which is just almost like a new tax layer that is hate on the miners that has to be factored in. The time to bring miners, it actually increases the barrier to entry, given, and it leads to even bigger lags. You're no longer turning around oil tankers. It's almost like you're trying to turn around planets. We're going to feed into it. Surely we get an even bigger overshoot necessary on the metals that leads to that multiplier overshoot potential. There could be a crypto market in miners to come in the not too distant future. Is that possible?
Yes, and I think what's been driving the gold price is definitely the speculation due to the problems we're seeing with inflation, which we had in 2021 into 2022. And then all of a sudden, it looked like we're going to really go into more of a deflationary wave. And then the banking crisis began. And that, so we had the Russian-Ukraine war. We had a lot of people move into gold. And then we had the dollar really start to fall. And that was started in November. And so the gold and silver went up due to the dollar index falling. And you could see it was a pretty good inverse correlation. That's not always the case, but that was the case up until January and February. And then when it looked like metals would start to roll over, we had the banking crisis. And from what I understand, Francis, this banking crisis is not solved. And so I think moving forward, the catalyst is going to be more problems. And you know what's interesting? It's the problem with quality collateral. That's the problem in the banking sector. And really, what's the most high quality collateral you can get really is gold. Treasuries, the U.S. treasuries are right now what the market wants, but the real pristine collateral is gold. And so I think that's why it'll see a much larger move due to the problems with the banking sector.
Great comment. I brought up one of your charts. Let's share that screen. I'll go to the entire window and we'll show this one. This one I'm putting up is the global oil discoveries versus net global oil production. Talk us through this as you see it, Steve. What are we looking at?
Basically, what you see, if you look at 1970s, we produced 188 billion barrels of oil. In the 1980s or 1970s, we discovered 436 billion barrels. So we added 248 billion barrels to our inventories, our reserves. But you see, since the 1980s, that we had discoveries, but you'll notice the olive color, that is the difference between how much we produced and how much we discovered. So in the 2000s, we consumed 147 billion barrels more oil than we discovered. In 2010, it was 215 billion barrels more. And then my estimate is in for the 2020s, if production remains constant, we're only finding one barrel of oil for every five barrels we're finding. This is the data. And so the issue is, when we understand these fundamentals, for whatever reason, I don't know the factors involved. I have my own understanding about it, but this is why we're going to get into trouble with oil prices. So did it go into?
And jump in, Steve. It's less maybe a peak oil thing, more than it's a peak $70, $80 oil thing. There might be plenty if you're paying $250 potentially, and it'll open up new exploration and new aspects. So price almost feels, again, like it's got to play a role in here. You're not a peak oil theorist out and out. In other words, we just run out of the stuff, are you?
Well, honestly, I do think at some point we do peak. And the reason for that, and we don't need to get into that, has to do with the energy return on investment. But the issue is, we did peak in conventional oil. And what we have aided up is with the unconventional. And, you know, that's fine. But here's the clincher. The oil sands in Canada, for every million barrels a day that they produce in oil sands for Francis, they have to burn a billion cubic feet a day of their natural gas to process that. So they've got the natural gas but we need to understand they need a lot of energy to produce that oil sands. And I'll talk about this. The shale is
messy oil. I've always understood it to be messy, dirty, needing a lot of processing oil. So it's a very heavy, high cost. We've got all
it's a high cost.
And then we
realize this when the oil price gets so high, even though it could bring on more discoveries, and it will, the market can't afford too high of a price, right?
No. And this divergence.
And so it's you get high inflation, then consumers cut back because energy is costing more. And my concern, Francis, is we're going not only going to see high oil prices, gasoline, diesel, we're going to see high natural gas and electricity prices, which the market, except Europe last year, hasn't really felt that. And so that's another dynamic that's coming into play.
I absolutely can see that happening, and I totally concur. And surely price again has to be the thing that starts to fix this, because you've got to go further, you've got to do more water offshore, you've got to do much more costly drilling. The easy pickings, the low-hanging fruits are gone. You've got to do much more exploration. The only thing that solves this surely has to be significantly higher prices, which comes back to your statement. You think we'll see 200 plus 250 in due course, not just on dollar devaluation. Yes, we have a fiat crisis, but in a relative sense, even if we have oil against something else that isn't being printed or proliferated, we're going to see energies as a complex become relatively larger in people's budgets generally.
That's correct. And so when you start seeing higher prices, that does impact the bottom line. And what's interesting, like they're discovering oil off Guyana. Exxon's doing some nice discoveries so far, Francis. This is one of the good spots. They found about 11 billion barrels. We consume 30 billion a year. So far, they've discovered about a 4-month supply. So you just, when you put those numbers, you understand what we're facing. And so there's a few of the charts there that kind of describe this more in detail, because it's important, because I think the stagflation energy issue is going to be the foundation of why we're going to see increased volatility and higher energy prices driving a lot of inflation.
In fact, if I can comment in that as well, again, it feels like a lot of insiders know this, and that might be the driver behind these 15-minute cities and a lot of current initiatives that are already working at the reduced freedom of movement. Because we've made predictions that discount airlines, cheap airlines for Joe Soap, just aren't going to be in existence in the future.
No, you're right. You're right.
We see this on a number of levels. Draconian control is one, a bit of Bolshevik communism. But B, the narrative you're giving is it's almost a forced imperative. on that this kind of travel can't be justified or validated anymore for the everyday peasant. The true cost for these businesses to continue to survive are going to be much, much, much significantly higher. The word discount and affordability are just not going to come into that anymore. I've brought up your global oil, and I'm just going to get back to sharing the screen because you've got some awesome charts, and we are very chart-driven.
There is one. Yes, there's one there that shows the from 1960s to 2020s. It's a bar chart that shows the annual decline rate. And that is important to kind of understand what the global oil industry is facing moving forward to adding production and maintaining it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't believe this is the one, but we'll get to all of them. Let's do a few of the charts. Talk us through this, and we'll pick up the thread when we get to the bar chart, shall we?
Yes. Back in the 60s, OPEC was a large was a pretty significant percentage of global oil supply. But now OPEC is one third, and non-OPEC is two thirds, about 62 million barrels a day. OPEC's
I've labored under the perception there were at least 60, even 70%, which is why they had the clout. I'm surprised they have that clout. So they have the clout they do with 30% of the supply. I suppose it's at the margin, invariably. If you have an organized 30%, they can tip you into deficits or surplus very easily, I suppose, at the end of the day.
Especially when they are major exporters. You see, there's a lot of countries that produce a lot of oil, but they consume most of it. OPEC does not. They export most of it. So you're right. So what this chart basically shows, and the olive color, and it flipped since the financial crisis. If you look from 97 to 2008, the growth in the world came from the rest of the world, which is the olive color.
Yeah.
Now, since 2008 to about 2019, the rest of the world is flat.
Yeah.
The growth came from the U.S. in blue and Canada, which is oil sands. So when we understand that really, to pull us out of the global financial crisis, you could do money printing and QE, but you have to have the energy to back it up, or you look like Venezuela, which is hyperinflation. And so it's important to understand this is where the growth came from. As a matter of fact, my analysis shows, we'll get to that chart, but this is the thing. Now, we have another chart I want to show you, but the natural decline rate, which is in 97, I estimate it was about 5.7 million barrels a day, 2008, 7.5. Now it's about 10. And I've got another chart that kind of shows that. This, when we stack up the natural decline rates of the oil industry, what they have to replace each year, it's now a tenth. We're losing one out of every 10 barrels we produce every year, where if you go back 10, 20, 30 years ago, it was much less. And so this is I call it kind of the Red Queen syndrome. We're burning through so much oil now, 30 billion barrels a year. We're losing about 10 million of about the 94, 95 million barrels a day every year now. And so we have to continue to replace that. And that is being done, but that becomes difficult because, as I showed you in the discoveries chart, we're not really replacing a lot of reserves. So this is why I see energy becoming very expensive.
Very, very interesting. Let's carry on with the charts and see if we can locate the one you are looking for. Which is the bar chart? I've got global oil production estimated annual oil decline. Do you want to take a turn?
That's it right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
This is great stuff. Loving it.
You see, the oil industry says that the global decline rate is about 6%. But the issue is, when we understand that non-OPEC is now 62 or two-thirds of that, where have they made that production up in the last two, three decades? Offshore. And then we have shale. And you know, shale
So on that point, that's 30% of that OPEC controls. But are they the net exporter? So if we take out their own personal consumption, what percent are they of the net exporting for other nations' use? Is that the 30% or is it higher?
No, that's the issue. There is the, and I have this number. I can't, the issue is like Saudi Arabia, if you go back to the 1980s and now they're producing about the same amount of oil, but guess what? Their demand has gone up. They are consuming now 3.5 million barrels a day of their 10, 11.
Yeah.
In the 1980s.
All those sheikhs and Gottis.
Yeah, the net exports are actually, they're staying the same, but I think we're going to see those decline if they continue with their demand increase. Now, what's interesting, you go back to 65, we're producing about 32 million barrels of production a year. A lot of that was OPEC. And the decline rate was about 1.3 million barrels a day. Now, as we added more offshore, which declines in the teens every year, and then we added 8 million barrels a day of U.S. shale, and then you have to tack on the natural gas plant liquids, that's 12 million barrels a day just for the United States. Francis, that declines 33% a year.
Wow.
Every year. So when you add up the OPEC decline rate, when you add up the non-OPEC minus U.S. and then United States, my estimate is it's about 10 million barrels a day. So next year in 2024, we got to replace 10 million. And then in 25, we got to replace 10 million. And in 20, now if we grow it, let's say we get it up to 104, 105, then you've got to replace maybe 11 million.
Yeah.
And so this is the problem that the oil industry is facing, regardless of peak oil or money printing. This is the dynamic that they're facing.
Gotcha. So actually, even with a very high price, we're going to face some degree of squeeze, and this might be a driver behind that freedom of movement as well that we're seeing so many initiatives, government initiatives on. This is fascinating stuff, Steve. Let's carry on with your great chart. So essentially, this forecast that I'm just having some fun drawing some lines, but the estimated annual decline, which is essentially the rate at which the shorter the life that these things have of different sources. As we are going further afield, going offshore, doing shale, we know that you get much diminishing returns kicks in at a far more aggressive rate. You even mentioned 33%, I think, on some of them in shale, possibly. I can't remember which category that was. In essence, this decline is going to continue up with the blue line, and we're stuck with the Saudis. They using more, not finding much more, and may even be peaking out on outputs on their own. So there is a squeeze, a real squeeze coming on that maybe even price can't fix. We need to reduce demand drastically, in essence. The control of the world may be thinking.
I agree with that. Is that peak oil? I don't know if that's peak oil, but it comes down to the data. I look at the data. The data tells me what's going on. I don't, and sometimes I'm proven wrong. But when you look at these numbers and you understand that the U.S. shale oil production declines 40-45% a year, the natural gas liquids about 35%. So when you add them together, it's about 33%. That's lost every year. And so, and there was one last, well, I showed you the chart with, but you get the idea. And I really didn't know kind of how critical these numbers were until I did the calculations. And so I just wanted to share with your followers, because I think we're setting up for, in the next several years, much higher energy prices, and that thunders through food prices and it thunders through all goods and services.
And we're really putting the stag into stagflation, because that's going to lead to global economic growth being totally constrained, lot reduced movements, holidays becoming super expensive, foods being super expensive, base costs going up immensely. It's no wonder we've seen this splurge of World Economic Forum initiatives and all these different feed ideas. Let's get into the mine bits. I think these other three charts refer to mining. Shall we start with the gold quarterly? How does this roll into something like precious metals, Steve? What's your take? Let me open this chart so that you've got that to refer to as well.
Yeah, some some analysts look at charts only, and so they look at gold. And a famous example would be Harry Dent, because he has talked about he's got some very interesting analysis about demographics, which is true, but he says that gold in a crash could go back to its pre-bubble in 2004 of $400.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why I don't see that was because I understand what it takes to produce gold. And we have gone through a lot of the high, I mean, we went through a lot of the high grade stuff over the last hundreds of years. And now we're trying to get the open pit. And the average tends to be about 1.5 grams a ton. So if you're moving a lot of earth to get this gold, basically it's gold dust now. I used Homestake Mining. I've used a lot of the top gold miners, and the quarterly chart shows you the price of gold. All I've done is went to Homestake Mining, other gold miners, and I found out what their cost of production was. And it is interesting. Now, I didn't make this dynamic. The market priced it in somehow, right? We had the big move in the 70s that was due to the money supply and the inflation of oil. And then we see the two decades of kind of like just, it didn't really go anywhere. And then what happened in the 2000s, we had a big move in the oil price. And that was part of the reason for the gold cost to go up. Well, if the gold cost has go up, so is the price. And now,
you're actually nailing that. I just want to remind everybody on oil, because not everyone has your encyclopedia for prices or charts. Oil peaked out at 147 that you described in 2007, the peak of the subprime crisis, and had come up from very, very low lows, 30s.
19 and 15, $19, right?
Yes, we were in a $10 to $15 range just before that. So during this period, you actually went up to 150, almost 150. I think Brent traded 150, but WTI was, as you said. So that was a huge cost, and that's seen this staircase. So this is why the relative valuation of gold and oil is so interesting to me, because they actually also have an effect on each other. And you need them both to be strong. If you want gold to be strong, a strong oil price will also do it. And in actual fact, the miners are yet to have a significant separation of profitability above cost. They're really only just staying above. The gold price is only really just staying above cost price by, you know, a handful of, there's not a lot of margin for error if you look at this, Steve. It's hardly like they're making, you know, they're just hemorrhaging cash on low cost, extreme, abnormal profits price, you know, as you get taught in economics.
Yeah, and what's interesting, if you look at the move from 2008 when it bottomed, to 2011, when you look at that move, the gold price really outperformed energy for a while, and the miners did really well at that period. The issue is they have gone through a decade of reserves, and they've done some share dilution. They've added debt. And so when you do that, if you're going to do share dilution, it's going to impact the value of the stock. And so now what they're doing is they're treading we see the cost. And now there is, not to get into too many details, there is the all-in sustaining cost. The problem I have with that is that's really not the true cost. That's why I show 1550. Now, this is the top 7-8 gold miners I go by. Yeah. And I look at their adjusted net income, and I also look at their free cash flow. And that, and you know what's interesting? Even though they say they may have a 1,200 all-in sustaining cost, well, their adjusted income and their free cash flow does not really dictate that price. And so when you, and then of course we're not considering the debt that has been added, and also the share dilution. So my number of 1550, it seems to be a realistic price for the gold mining industry right now in quarter four.
Yeah,
in quarter four. And so I think this is the dynamics now that we're seeing in the gold mining industry.
So price not only should be moving, it almost has to move on account of cost And you can't keep diluting, you can't keep adding debt, because all the original owners are just getting whittled away. And they're owning more debt that they have obligations towards. So yeah, it makes absolute sense. It makes absolute sense. Fantastic.
Now, there are people who disagree with this analysis. They say because there's all this gold that central banks hold, so it's a cost of it is like a stock to flow. But the thing is, I don't make this chart up. I just put the cost in there. And so yep. If somebody wants to buy the 3,500 tons of gold mined every year, they're going to have to pay what it costs to produce it.
Yeah.
It really comes down to that. If we didn't have the demand, then yes. But I think that the demand for gold is going to be taking off in the years ahead.
Especially now as we are getting this... The damage to the dollar, I was explaining this in another video, is not good news for the euro, the yuan, and all of them. None of them are viable alternatives. It's bad news for fiats because the dollar is king fiat. Gold, and even Bitcoin, many will argue, is an anti-fiat, but gold you hold. There's no surveillance that goes along with that. It's physical and you can keep it on you. This is good for the anti-fiats. And it's terrible for fiats generally. So we are actually seeing people looking for the counterparty risk-free alternative to any fiat, rather than, oh, we're running from dollars to euros, we're running from dollars to yuan. Yes, in a relative FX sense, you might get dollar coming off and a bit more of a bid under the yuan if they're doing more bilateral trade with Brazil in Chinese yuan, et cetera, you'll slowly be seeping in, you know, the world's reliance on your currency if you're in China, but it's not a confidence play. The confidence play is gold, isn't it? So talk us through the similar analogy is silver right now. And it seems we've recently traded below cost on silver.
Yeah, silver tends to be more volatile. And what I'm showing here in the fourth quarter, about 2050, this is the top primary silver mine, which includes Fresnillo, which is the largest silver producer. And so the people will come back and say, well, Steve, only 30% of silver comes from primary. So why do you go by? Well, the market still needs that 30% of silver. If we didn't have it, what would the price be? And then if you look at the base metal miners, Francis, like KGM, Pulesca, I brought this up, they produce 40 million ounces as a byproduct of copper producing in Poland. They lost money. They lost money last quarter. So they actually have a hedging program for their silver. They need all the revenue they get, so they're not selling their silver. So a lot of the base metal miners, or even the gold miners that have some silver as a byproduct, they're not giving it away. They're using whatever they're using that price of silver to fortify their balance sheet. So when you look at the gold miners that have a $15.50 cost of production, if you take out all their silver byproduct, the cost of production would be even higher. They needed the silver to help fortify their balance sheet. So it really comes down to this price action, or this cost of production is a pretty good indicator of the overall ability to mine silver, even if it's primary, base metal, or even gold, gold byproduct gold. And so, yes, it does go below it, because silver is more volatile. But now, if you look at this chart, you'll see it tends to also hit the cost of production. And we have extreme volatility for various reasons.
And on top of that, it's consumed and often not reclaimed, because the value of doing so is non-economic because of current price levels in screen. So unlike the gold, where people will argue that there is all the unmined gold, most large portions of it are sitting in vaults, even though I would argue those people ain't selling, those kind of people.
Right.
But set that aside, silver's consumed. It's largely gone and it's wasted. You can't find it. It's dispersed into the ether. And the prices are way too low to aggregate and extract at current levels.
I agree. And this is why I believe silver is going to probably outperform gold over the longer term. There's a lot of people who think gold is the king monetary metal. It is. But when we start to get into real trouble with fiat, there's way too much debt in the system. When you try to access silver, Francis, there's just not a lot of it, as a lot of it's been consumed. So you're absolutely right.
So this, and it's very prone to absolutely schizophrenic mega surges. And we saw how it suddenly got on its bike. And this to me was a truncated bull. Many people were around for 2012 that weren't around for the early 80s. You and I suspect, were around for both, although we wore younger men's clothes, I'm sure, in the 80s.
Yes.
I would say most people don't realize this was actually a truncated bull as well. It had the, you know, we had very depressing macroeconomics that went hand in hand in that. That was all the post 2007 and 8 environment. I would argue a full blown depression that was working in hand in hand with us. So I think we've yet to see something that resembles the 80s. And given how long it's been postponed, we actually end up with something far bigger than even the 80s itself.
I agree. I totally agree. And we have to understand, even though there was a recession in the early 80s due to the high energy prices and the high interest rates and all that, we still brought on a lot more oil. And then in 2008, after the global financial crisis, we added 12.5 million barrels a day of new growth. 93% of that came from the U.S. And so now the U.S. is going to be difficult to maintain this shale production. And so this is the reason why we get, I call it stagflation from hell. Because then we start to, we really don't have a lot of new supply that can be brought on after 1980s and after the 2008, which gave us those declines and those bottoms. We will get one, but they're not going to be like 2.5 decades in the 80s and about a decade, you know, from 2010 or 11, from 2011-12 to later on. And so I think this next wave of the bull market is going to be much sooner, and it's going to be much higher due to the problems we're going to see with the energy inflation.
That is such an interesting thing. You know, I've continued to talk about hyperstagflation, and everybody is thinking I'm referring to the 70s, and I'm saying no, that was known as stagflation. What we're going to do relative to the 70s is on a next level degree of extremity. And I'm loving how you've made your argument. This is a beautifully structured presentation that you've given us today. And I want to thank you for your effort. And it's clear you're passionate about your work. What you're actually showing is the combination of that oil effect feeding into, and people really need to understand how much energy it takes to make a massive hole deep down in the ground.
Right.
Bring all the proceeds back up to the surface against gravity, crush it all and extract. In terms of energy investment, they really, really need to understand that. And if they understand where we're going with oil and gas and all of these elements, and they truly see all of that, and now they've got to see we're having coincident with it a loss of faith in fiat currencies that's going to see particular attractiveness for the monetized metals of silver and gold, with none of the above ground really kicking around in silver. Do you have a view? This is one of, and sometimes people say it's not the right question because it's not, most of it's not for sale. But the above ground silver seems to be a voodoo number no one really can put their finger on. But we've been tapering that down by most people's impressions substantially for an extended period. Where does all the Teslas and the battery cars silver come from in the future? What's your take on what's above ground and the fact that it's consumed? Why is it so hard to get numbers? Is it a conspiracy, or what's your sketch that one out for us?
Well, I think the issue is most investors want to buy something that provides a yield, and gold and silver are dead metals and they don't do that.
Yes.
And so this is why they're kind of unloved. And so people get into tech stocks, they have all their retirement accounts because, you know, when we retire, we don't want to sell any of our retirement account. We want it to earn money.
Yeah.
Well, Francis, that only works if you get the oil industry to continue adding that oil.
Yeah.
And so now when that becomes kind of a problem, then a lot of those retirement accounts start to get into trouble. And so my estimate is there's about twice as much investment silver above ground. 5 billion plus or minus ounces of investment silver, and there's about 2.5 billion ounces of gold. Now, if there's a lot of silver and jewelry and other things, silverware, that can come into the market if prices get high. But we in when prices got up to 50, we did get more recycling, but not that much. So I think the reason why it's going to be difficult to when these constraints come, that's when the demand for silver is really going to increase. And I think actually it's not going to be industrial demand. It's going to be investment demand. That's going to be the ultimate driver of silver as it's competing, Francis, with all the problems with fiat and the debt. We've doubled the debt, $150 trillion in the last 14 years. We doubled it in just 14 years. So when you're competing with all this paper, and it's now it's getting into trouble, and it gets into more trouble when we get into problems with energy, this is why I do like that term, hyperstagflation. And the problem on the other side, you'll get high prices, very high prices of goods and services and energy, but then you get deflation in assets you own. And that is the other thing, as more investors transition out of it, real estate, different real estate, into more sound investments, because I think real estate is in trouble, in especially first commercial. And so when you understand these dynamics, it just becomes much more positive for the metals and even the miners.
Eventually, enough capital growth looks after yield, doesn't it? If you ignore it for long enough that it has such extreme capital growth because it's been so unloved, and if the yield space is so overcrowded on the wrong side of demographics, we you know, peak boomer retirement last year, November, and that means more guys extracting and needing that yield and selling stocks and not needing umpteen holiday homes in the Hamptons and, you know, Colorado, Aspen, etc. That means, and never mind international, you start to see distribution and a smaller generation coming up underneath it. Real estate, commercial, jeez, you're scaring me when you talk about commercial. I like commercial real estate. If there's an area I'm more bearish on, it's urbanized, high-rise commercial. I mean, New York, my goodness. I think that's a bath. And all that debt being, we've had essentially a super cycle of hyper-financialization all in the search of yield. We pursued yield so far that eventually we had subprime. We were doing bad loans to bad people, not bad morally bad, but bad underwriting, to the extent that we were chasing yield so much. And you got the securitization and all of that. And that cycle has to end, and the great unloved becomes the hot, and the yield search that sees ridiculous prices paid for very small yield all has to unravel. And that's why I don't feel equities are the most interesting, generally. People always ask me, what's right. S&P 500 is going to do? What's this? I'm like, man, you're going to see rotation like you've never seen. It could go nowhere, and a whole bunch of companies could have gone bust, and others could have gone up 100 times. You know, where do you want to play? Why play the general market when I can point you in the hot areas? You know, don't talk to me about indices. Talk about industries specific. Are they the financial, hyper-financialized industries? Or are they going to be the ones affected by these drivers that you're highlighting here? This is brilliant stuff. I'm going to bring up your next chart, Steve. This is USA versus rest of the world.
Okay, and even though this is an energy one, this is good to conclude on these charts, because it really shows quite simply that the world added 12.5 million barrels a day of growth. And you know what's fascinating? A gentleman named John Manjakovici did a presentation in 2019 in front of the OECD, and he's got a chart showing that global GDP is based on global oil consumption. So global GDP per capita is based on global oil consumption. So when oil consumption goes up, the increase, then we see increase in GDP. And it just makes common sense. So when you understand, if you look across these, if you look at the rest of the world, it added 0.9 million barrels a day of the 12.5. That's 7%. The U.S. added 11.6. This is oil condensate, natural gas liquids. So,
and when you say USA, that's going to be fracking, because there was the moment. So the reason I love energies, for one or other reason, the charts have particularly spoken to us on that. And we're famous for calling the single-digit oil crash that preceded COVID events, etc. Technically, without your degree of knowledge. And the fascinating thing is the U.S. went independent of oil under Trump. That was being driven, I believe, by the fracking, my assessment, to correct me where I'm wrong. But they took essentially, I think it was 2 million barrels of oil a day out of demand in the global rest of the world market. And that saw Russia, when they were not cooperating with Saudi, there was a meeting and they refused. They both were going to pump for their money. So OPEC, as the marginal provider of great note, said no, everybody for themselves. They all surplus glut. Essentially, we had a glut because everybody wanted to get a number in revenue terms, in dollar terms at that point. And the more the price went down, the more they had to produce. There was also strong arming of Venezuela, Iran, and the U.S. wanting to inflict financial potential hardship on Russia in lieu of its strong energy position, which has preceded the NATO aggressiveness in Ukraine and everything else. So it's a really fascinating how oil, geopolitics, and I love that summary of GDP is basically oil. It is the Rockefeller tax. If you're having the property boom, the oil price runs, and it's how they skim some of that wealth back that you're getting out of your ATM, that is your house price. And then when we depress demand, it goes down. They take the foot off the gas on that. It's fascinating, the relationship of oil and the energy, the markets. I'm so excited by this. I've forgotten almost what I was going to ask.
If you look at the chart, I don't mean to interrupt you, Francis. No, you'll see in 2020, in November 2020, where did most of the decline come from?
It was the rest of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though we shut down a lot of oil, look where the U.S. cut a little bit, but the majority came from the rest of the world. And so what's also fascinating about the light tight oil, we can't consume all of that light tight oil in the U.S. because our refineries are geared more towards medium and heavier oil. So we export about three or more million barrels a day of this light tight oil, and we import 7 million barrels a day of what we call medium oil. And so even though we've become energy independent, that really only works because we need this medium grade oil to process all the different diesel, gasoline, jet fuel, and unfortunately, light tight oil does not produce a lot of diesel, and diesel is the number one energy source. So there's an interesting dynamics. But if we look at this, when Bernanke and Paulson came out and backstopped the entire economy in 2009, they did all that money printing, and people think it was the money printing that saved us. No, it was that growth that came from the United States. Because I've talked fracking. About this before. Yes, it was the fracking. It was the energy growth that brought us out of the recession. It's the same thing when you go back to the Depression in the 1930s in the United States. People say that Roosevelt's New Deal or World War II.
That New Deal story, garbage, yeah.
No, we were the Saudi Arabia. By 1940, Francis, the U.S. was producing 7 of the 10 barrels of oil in the world.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia never produced that much oil. And so it was the oil growth that pulled us out of that recession. And so this is why I just want people to realize that if you don't have this oil growth, you could do money printing and QE, but you look like Venezuela. And so if we don't have the growth like we did in the last 14 years, and we go back to QE and money printing, we're going to see very, very big, very high inflation. That's why I do agree with you with this hyperstagflation that's coming.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're spot on. And I mean, the color you've added to this discussion and the way people will perceive the critical role of oil, that literally you can reduce it down to activity is gross domestic product. Activity is represented single-handedly, most simply stated, in oil consumption and production, and equally, because you obviously, if you're just consuming stocks, you're depleting, and you've got a wall that you're going to hit. That's been absolutely fascinating. So in terms of the fact that we may get a temporary dip, but overall everything going so much higher, who do you love most? You've got your three sons here, silver, gold, and the blackhead oil one. Which one do you like most in terms of outright? Let's just talk the commodity, not individual equity plays. Which one do you like for absolute upside growth? If you could have stored, let's just forego the cost and the practicalities, $1 million in the most regular consumed oil of this, the American people, $1 million of gold, $1 million of silver. Which one are you taking for us meeting together in 2.5 years' time and saying, who's done the best out of the three of us? Which one are you taking?
If it was a little bit longer period, I would definitely take silver over the three. Yeah. But
I intentionally did that, by the way, because 5 and 10, I'm on silver too.
Yes, five. I agree with you. It's amazing how much we agree. I do. I actually, in the shorter term, 2 years plus, we may. It's going to be a tie between oil and gold.
Gold.
Yes, but it could be oil first. But I do think in the little bit longer term, I think it's going to be silver. So that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, yeah. Silver wins.
And you don't have to do anything fancy with gold, right? You could purchase gold. Now, there's many ways you can purchase gold. But if you purchase physical gold, you store it. With oil, you don't really put oil in your backyard. And so you've got to trade it. And to trade oil, either you do that to ETF or on the futures. So gold and silver may be easier for some people who aren't as extensive, sophisticated traders. So if that's also a condition, maybe the metals may be the easier bet for less sophisticated investors.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sound advice. I mean, there's obviously a lot of looking after that goes on. In fact, oils can decay. I'm told, if you're not careful, you've got to, how they're stored. It's very complicated. I'm out of my depth there, but I've got a little bit of knowledge that tells me it's not a simple business. So that's fascinating. And then if we rotate that into the explorers, there's going to be winners in new find oil companies, possibly new find precious metals companies. Again, do you have a bias? Would you buy an oil ETF, junior exploration miners, or would you take a GDXJ? Where do you stand on the equity front, given the leverage? Because, of course, the miners have the downside of the good move in the oil is also bringing up their cost quite exponentially under them at the same time. But they get the benefit of the financial defiatization, let's just say, or where debt search for yield, this hyper financialization era comes to a close. So which one wins out of that? Are the costs going to spoil it a bit for the miners, or are we going to just there will be one or two moonshooters? How are you choosing that? If you had to have an ETF of equities, which one are you taking?
Francis, that's one of the things I have to reflect on and think about all the time, because I talk to my subscribers. I used to believe in the miners and the energy stocks as buy and hold. I do not believe that anymore, because the extreme volatility can kill you. And so the issue going forward, if I had to choose between producers and explorers, I would probably pick the larger producers.
Yes,
like the Exxons. Because the issue is... So
that's big cap, right? What we call, not just producer, that's actually a major player, isn't it?
So that's a major player. I would think the major players are safer and they produce. They're going to have the same issues going forward as the smaller producers, but they have many areas of extraction. They're global. Companies that may be in fracking only, they're limited to their drilling locations, and these are not unlimited. So Exxon's out there finding more discoveries off Guyana, and so I think the larger caps are the place to be in oil, and even the natural. I think one of the biggest plays is probably going to be the natural gas once it bottoms, and you probably agree. Yeah. Natural gas stocks. And there's a good handful of those. I think those are going to really do well once they bottom. But I don't think they've bottomed yet. And so the natural gas stocks are going to do well. But I would not hold on to those. Those would be trades. Those would be trades. And then the miners, here's what I'd say about the miners in conclusion. I still like the larger miners. Yes, there are a lot of miners. There's even some smaller producers that are more economic. But I like the mid-cap, the larger miners, and even in the silver miners the same way, better than the juniors. But here is the caveat with junior explorers. If we're going to have issues with energy, a lot of these never make it to the market anyhow, but it's going to be very difficult to become commercial mine if we start to get into that crunch that you showed in the chart.
Yeah.
It's going to be difficult to take that reserve and make it a commercial mine. But that is one thing. If it's got gold or silver in the name and people start really, and the metals really take off, these explorers can take off. So these are the dynamics. But it's hard to pinpoint which explorer is going to do that. So that's why I tend to look more.
Put them in the gambler's portfolio a little bit. You have your spine, which will be the majors and the medium size that are already good producers with good track record or the known management. And then you maybe have a few high flyers.
Speculation on the, yes, that's the wisest way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the wisest way to do it. Yes.
I was talking actually to a gentleman by the name of John Lee recently, and he has a very small market cap. I'd call it a micro cap silver miner. He's not yet at production, but he has proven ores in the ground. So he's not exploration. And he's getting as close as to be oven ready as he can get. And his company has a 20 million market cap, and he has 100 million ounces in the ground. And he believes he can bring 10 million ounces a year out for a decade. It was very, very interesting. And I was thinking, could be an interesting category or example of a more speculative gambler's portfolio on the silver price, because if those come right, those things can go from 20 million market cap to 3 or 4 billion if he gets it ready.
They move the most. Right. And I think, that's an interesting dynamic, because I think there's going to be a time, this is still some time down the road, where there's going to be a lot of demand for physical metal.
Yeah.
And I think the ability to get that, we could see very high prices. And so what's the next best thing is to get the mining stock, because it's got the metal, the future metal supply. Even though they may have to shut down a mine because if they've got five mines, they'll shut down a very high cost mine, but they still have four mines and the price of the metals are much higher. So yes, I think we could see a transition to what you talked about, hyper financialization. That was great, but I think the market may start to transition and pivot into these mining stocks, because finance may not seem to be as profitable or as a ongoing venture as real money, which is gold and silver. And so I think that's something that I would say I agree with you on the mining stocks.
No, I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. And I've got such a clear synopsis as well. And as I say, as you mentioned, we do dovetail a lot on a lot of the matters. There are so many epochs that seem to be ending that all are so supremely bullish. We've had an extended cycle of financialization and searching of yield, so that the point of anything that doesn't provide a yield is barely produced at just above cost, as you so nicely illustrated in your charts, when actually they should be very hyper normal profits to even potentially super normal profits when everybody wakes up to the pivot in the priorities of our society. I wonder, and I don't know how much you think about these topics. I don't want to take you down a rabbit hole you don't want to go down, Steve, but in terms of the likes of the government initiatives that are looking to have these 15-minute cities of people, it feels like there's almost been a right sizing of the population and a right sizing of the population's ability to move in preemption of known economic drivers, such as the wall that you've painted for us in terms of energy. It seems like the people high up enough know. Could they, in lieu of their reaction, it's impossible to take the full sting out of this, but could they at least dampen it down by the fact that population growth that goes down, population growth is flattening, the World Economic Forum leaders can still whiz around in their jets, everyone else is not getting discount airlines anymore, there's a couple of business class airlines only, they cost 5 or 6 times more, and they're few and far between, and they fly on certain days, everybody else sits still, pretty much in their little 15-minute village, and growth rates in terms of births and demographics are slowing down. How much of an effect on actual demand and other efficiencies, let's say a better green, assuming they chip in like they're supposed to, I don't have much faith in wind, but nonetheless, a lot more solar goes on, which of course is also going to be beneficial for silver. How much sting could they take out of this wall that essentially you're seeing us doing 300 kilometers per hour towards? In terms of the demand, the lack of supply and the demand overshoot?
Well, if we go down the rat hole of the conspiracies, the big one is the COVID, right? Because yeah. look what that did to oil demand. And so the thing is, from what my best analysis, Francis, is that we did the QE in 2008 because we hit peak conventional oil production. Now, I don't know if Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Paulson know that, but they came in, and so then we brought on all this energy, and then we hit the second energy crisis in 2021-22, and then what did they do? They increased interest rates.
Yeah.
What they're doing now is trying to put out fires, but the fires are getting bigger, and so now that they've increased the interest rates, look what it's done to a lot of these banks that are holding these mortgages or treasuries that are under, they've lost a lot of value. And so in doing this kind of manipulation, and it is manipulation, they are manipulating rates, they are, and you could, I mean, a chiropractor manipulates us, and they're trying to do it what they think, maybe they're not doing it correctly, but I think going forward, I think we are in serious trouble, and I do think the problems we're going to be facing is more cutback in the ability of supply. And so, what happened in COVID? People left the cities because you couldn't move around, you couldn't get food. I think we're going to see another after 2025. I think we're going to, as inflation really hits up and energy prices go up and housing costs, I think people are going to start moving further away from the big cities.
Yeah. So you had urban sprawl. Now we're going to have a rural sprawl almost.
Yes.
In terms of how people choose to live. I've got another theory that I espoused many years ago, and I repeated it, and I continue to this day to maintain this. And you've done nothing to undermine it. You've made so many points that absolutely support it. There was a lot of talk about the suboptimal nature of fracking. In other words, as an activity, it was financially very steep, diminishing returns. I think there were the broad speak numbers for the masses. Mm-hmm. Some people explained it as the first crack of the slate, you would scrape, you'd get X, and then you needed 3 cracks further to get you to a total of 4. So that's triple the cost. To harvest approximately the same you got on the first slate crack. And you had this parabola. You had to keep cracking. And of course, the cost was the chemical water that was being high-pressured mm-hmm. in there and all of this. So very steep diminishing return cycle. And what happened is the equity people got blown up in fracking because very quickly it returned. And then they started to do lending. They started to get financial support to frack for that 2 million barrels that tipped US into independence from being an importer. And it was the banks that were doing it. And I theorized that this was intentional. The banks were lending to a known non-longevity quite likely not able to pay back, and that they would almost knowingly know that there would be degrees of restructuring in that, on the basis that the oil that they were getting was more important and more useful than the additional debt and failure of that debt that would be packaged up, turned into toxic bank, maybe even written off when we reset in Jubilees. And as a result, it was a non-economic decision that was made for the even bigger reason of oil supply being the higher god of economic activity. And as a result, it's worth spending $15 of fiat debt that is numbers of a computer to make $10 of supply of oil. And the only reason I felt someone would do that, because it was clearly a not-for-profit activity to overlend and overextend and to continue, keep cracking, keep going, don't stop, keep going, we'll take everything you can get, don't worry about the money, you'll go overdrafts extended, etc., etc. I'm, of course, paraphrasing and being, you know, an entertainer here a little bit. But in essence, that felt to me like it was part of the economic decision to do a non-economic activity in one area because the overall contribution to the entire system was larger than the cost of making non-economic loans. What do you feel about that, just as a general theory?
I think you're spot on, because the issue we're facing is this falling energy return on investment of oil. And I mentioned this, if you were John D. Rockefeller and you were producing oil in the 30s, a typical well produced 100 barrels of oil for the cost of one barrel.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't fiat money, this is energy. In the 1970s, that fell to 30 to 1.
Yeah.
Oil sands is 4 to 1.
Yeah.
Shale oil is around 5 to 1. And so the issue is our global high-tech economy that's pumping out trillions or billions of semiconductors needs a very high energy return on investment. Well, shale and oil sands really isn't doing that. And so how do you do that? You do exactly what you say. You use finance to get out this less economic oil, and we will probably continue to do that. The issue is, you're basically, get this, even though it's debt we're using or money to produce this less economic oil, we're using more energy from somewhere else.
Correct.
We had to get that cheap steel from China to do these long 2-mile laterals. So we're using a lot of steel, a lot of it we get inexpensive from China. And so this only works if this whole system continues to be inexpensive. But as the price of that pipe goes up, then what happens now is you've got to steal more energy from the system to produce this oil. And so,
yeah.
But I think you're right. I think that's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they did.
It implies if you make sub-economic loans that are value-destroying to businesses that are selling $10 bills for $7 on the street corner, that the product is actually not priced correctly. And as much as we talk about gold and silver manipulation, the great manipulated commodity could in fact be oil, in terms of having true price discovery mechanisms. And we've lived in a captured, managed oil environment for pricing too. Could oil be one of the another commodity that is price manipulated? Because surely the only ways we have of finding it, where one barrel of expended effort and energy used to produce 100 barrels of oil, so you're getting a multiplier of 100, and now that has fallen 20x or 25x, depending on whether you're 4 or 5, at the marginal level, where we're now fracking and doing tar sands, not everything is that, admittedly. Surely that price should have reflected that and hasn't.
Yeah, and because what's interesting, when you had zero interest rates, they borrowed a lot of money. I think the shale industry at one time, they had $300 billion in debt, and you cannot finance that at high interest rates, right?
No.
So the only way shale was really economic at the time was by manipulating the interest rates.
Correct, which is part of the whole entire, this is my point about the entire financial mechanism being manipulated to allow for shale oil to have even be contemplated. in its current price level. It should maybe be orders of magnitude higher so that if it was true price discovery mechanism. But because we've got the Ponzi scheme is supporting the suppression of other GDP activity-related measures that are doing it. And I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I find it's, you know, you've opened a new door there for others to explore, and you've reminded me of something I've always felt. The financial system itself is involved in the manipulation of almost everything that is central to GDP in the commodity space. And I think oil is actually deserves to be included with silver and gold, although it's different. One is maybe a derivatives on a very light market where there's low delivery. The other is non-commercial lending.
Yeah, and all that was made possible by pushing the problems to the future, right? Because we now have 150, almost 300, it's 300 plus or minus trillion now. We only had 150 trillion in debt. And the issue going forward is what happens when that debt gets into trouble? So we have used financial rigging interest rates to bring on less economic oil. The problem going forward is what happens when this debt gets into trouble? Because someone's debt, as you know, is somebody else's asset.
Correct.
And where does capital come from?
Yeah.
And where does capital come from? Your asset values. So if the debt falls, and this is one thing I don't think people pay attention to, if the debt falls, the asset values fall, and then the capital falls to continue exploring more. It's a crazy dynamic. And so I don't know how much more debt we can add before this system really starts to kind of unravel within itself. And so I would love to hear your idea on that.
No, I think you're nailing it on the head. So when the events of March 2020 occurred, and I say that to try avoid provoking YouTube as much as possible, because I think this is going to be a great discussion that people are going to enjoy. We essentially said that the debt market had turned, the 40-year bull market had turned. That final blow-off, which saw in values, which was the capitulation in yields on the likes of the 10-year and everything, was once in a lifetime, and we think we turned that corner. So even though we're expecting lockdowns and various other activities to potentially materialize, possibly climate orientated, various other degrees, because they need to continually taking the sting out of demand. They have to kill, they have to have spells of demand to allow inventories to rebuild, various other things, I suspect, because they're battling to bring this to ground. I think we've turned on the rates. I think we're going to see stubbornly high rates and debt eventually lose value so that you get really high rates. You can't, it was Druckenmiller who said it, you can't kill an inflation. There's never been an instance, he said. So you can't say absolutely you can't, but there's never been an instance where you've gone beyond 5% in inflationary support forces levels, and you've killed that inflation without being significantly higher than the 5% inflation. In other words, you have to have a positive interest rate to inflation rate. You don't have negative real rates and win a battle against inflation. And in that realm, you've got the people in the middle who are overtaxed, overcharged on their energies already, but clearly possibly still undercharged in terms of the mechanization of what we were just discussing. And you've got a super elite that is spending money on the military industrial complex. We essentially have two economic planets, one where the government is primary buyer, which is communism, essentially. And my view is we already are in a very strong statist Bolshevik communism, people just not realizing it. The government is now the economy in everything, from interest rates to everything else. And they've been allowed for quite an extended period to paint themselves in the corner with the coercion of the corporatocracy, which is essentially what fascism is, the co-option of corporations. It's just communism using business entities that are co-opted. And this is why you have so much similarity of outcomes, whether it's the trans movement, suddenly through every major Nike's beer, every other, you know, major corporation. This is a synchronized leper colony where actually statism There is a hidden statism behind all of it that is decreeing certain things. So you are actually in a communistic realm in my worldview right now that is overextended. We are USSR, essentially, of the 80s, where instead of a Berlin Wall coming down, we're going to see a fiat currency system that has been the statist weapon of choice for manipulation with the co-option of the banking system and all the corporatocracies, which are the big monopolies. We talk of Rockefeller, Amazon is Rockefeller's, retail store where all the people who are paid in vouchers had to go and return the vouchers and are only allowed to buy their food and stuff back. So that he created a token currency long time ago. So we are in that entrapment era. And anything you physically can hold that has proven over years to hold value is the thing you should hold. You should physically custodian it. And this is why I am a silver and precious metals bull. And this is why people are failing to notice how far we already are deep into the communism, and we're almost into a USSR moment where they're telling you capitalism has failed, but you've actually had a decade, two decades of statism and intervention, which is actually the communism model which is failing, but it's being synchronized globally so that there is no real arbitrage for you to play. They're all suffering from the same degree. The media is helping shape the narrative that this is capitalism that's in failure, and you haven't had capitalism. I'll be the first to tell you, if capitalism ever breaks out, you haven't even had true price discovery mechanisms on the likes of the things that truly matter in terms of money and all of this. And inflation is policy, and it's got out of hand by them being late. And I almost feel that it's an intentional aspect to be late to it, so that they hopelessly deny its existence, then to overshoot too abruptly. And now they look stupid. So now he's got to regain the narrative, being regained credibility by seizing the inflation. So he over-tightens after turning too late and turning too fast, after ignoring that asset price inflation, ridiculously, all in the search of yield. We were in a cycle of perpetual pursuit of yield, the Goldilocks economy that Greenspan gave us. We were already inflationary once all the PE multiples and all the stock spread so far, all in the pursuit of yield. So we have this entire reversal of this complete perversion that is essentially a status creation. And we are all actually Russians in the USSR experiencing the collapse of a statist economy. And it'll be sold to you as capitalism has failed. Jump onto our CBDC and UBI, comply, and you'll get an even tighter version. And we have to resist that. That's my... executive, I don't know if I can dare call it a summary, it was quite a rant, but my executive summary of where we truly are. I don't know how that sits with you.
I think the issue going forward, I do agree with you, Francis. The central banks, the leaders have been managing the situation. Here's the left ball, the curveball. As this energy dynamic plays out, look what's happened in France with the protests, the pensions. There's two sides of that story, but it is an energy issue. And so I think in time, what happens when the central banks and the politicians and leaders begin to lose control? And so we've seen this before. And so the energy, the cheap energy brought these central governments the ability to manage. But as expensive and we start getting problems with energy, then what you see is you're going to have a lot more problems with the public. There's going to be a lot more rioting. There's going to be a lot more problems that are coming due to high energy prices, due to high food prices. And then I think we're going to have a lot of problems with these centralized governments trying to manage it. And so I see a breakdown in that. I do see a breakdown in that. And so that's kind of a positive sign, and hopefully we get leaders that come into that void and do something a bit different. But right now they're selling us a lot of misinformation, right?
So the Arab Spring goes global, which has always gone hand in hand with one of our predictions, huge social unrest. But I'm just seeing an ever more militant approach to suppression. That doesn't mean the unrest won't happen. I think it's going to absolutely happen. But I just see they declare martial law, you know, eventually. You've seen how aggressive the French police are. A lot of people are already theorizing that a lot of the immigrants, which instead of being women and swaddling breast babies, are actually military age men going into the European nations, and also I assume in the States and the southern border to a degree, are going to be given work in suppression as part of, you know, they'll get the work of being riot police. They're getting trained because it's easier to suppress citizens of another land that you've just come to. You have no affiliation, especially if you culturally hate them or you've seen them as a nation of oppression yourself. And so there's a deep concern that we're going to see a lot more violence on the street. Personally,
I agree.
Absolutely see that. And maintaining and holding your wealth away, security is going to be an underappreciated area of investment to protect any wealth that you have. And I can see the state no longer able to do this to a suitable level, or getting so tied up in its confusing inversion, perversion, fund the police, defund the police, that you need private security, even at a moderate level. You know, you would normally associate that with a millionaire pop star or business person who's got a few enemies in the business world. Now you're going to see that almost as a middle class thing. We're going to cocoon out. And that's another reason why the rural sprawl that we're likely to get, people are going to get rural and suburban to, you know, remote, that you also referred to. And we're going to probably have a globalized version of the Arab Spring going through the Western white European nations that are not known for, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails in the streets.
Yeah, I do think there's more problems coming just like that. It seems to be, it happens one place and then it moves to the others. And so with these energy issues, Francis, I see a world transitioning from building wealth to protecting it.
Preserve, yes.
Preserve. And I'm not saying people can't build wealth, but it was very easy to do it with growing energy production. Well, it's very difficult to do that model with stagnant production. So it's inflation. And so how do you protect your wealth and inflate? You get it into these metals. And so, and unfortunately, 99% of investors are geared towards the yield.
Yep.
That's where you're geared to.
Earnings per share, PE ratio.
Right.
It's all about yield.
And so it's the psychology of the market when it goes off. That's when you'll start to see big, big moves in these assets that store value or protect your wealth. So, but yeah, I do think we're going to see a move to more rural, because the cities were great. They are great, but they need a lot of energy to maintain them. And if energy is going to get into trouble and you've got all these liabilities of maintaining infrastructure and police and firemen, and it becomes more problematic. Well, the rule of thumb is it's easier to kind of survive these issues that are coming in a more rural setting. It didn't have to be out in the middle of nowhere, but it's easier because there's just less people. There's just so many people in the urban areas.
Yeah, this has been absolutely fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. Steve St. Angelo of the SRS ROCCO, ROCCO report. Steve, tell everybody how they can find and engage so that they can be kept up to date with your fascinating insights in both the energy markets, the effect of the energy markets in other key industries such as mining. How do they engage with you?
Thanks, Francis. I have the srsrockreport.com website. We have some public articles, but we have our subscribers that we put out the details. I'm also on Twitter. And what I'd like to get people to understand is the changing energy inventories. We know we're getting closer and closer to what my term is the energy cliff, because I do see when we have problems with the debt and the debt starts to implode, it's going to implode asset values. That's going to impact oil production. And we could see I call it cliff-like declines. We could see 2, 3 million, 4 million barrels come off in a year due to these systemic issues that are propped up by leverage. And so I look at how close are we getting to what I call this energy cliff scenario, is if the inventories, really like the SPR, if they continue to trend lower. And and so they fluctuate, natural gas fluctuates throughout the year, oil tends to fluctuate a bit, but if they continue to trend lower and lower, we're losing that buffer, and that's an important buffer. So I keep an eye, one of the things I keep an eye on is these energy inventories. And so it's very important to understand what is happening with those, because that's when we'll see very high volatile prices. I see high prices and shortages followed by low prices and surpluses. This isn't a one-way street, and you know that, because everything is cyclical and volatile. I just see the cyclicality and the volatility much quicker and much more extreme as time goes on.
Yeah, but a very definitive trend of much, much higher, despite higher lows.
Higher highs and higher lows. Bingo.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Francis.
No, you were an outstanding guest. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for your time. And I'm looking forward to when we next get you on. Appreciate it. And you know where to find Steve. And it's Rocco, R-O-C-C-O. We will put a link to his website below as well. Steve, thank you very much for your time. Have a great day.
You too, Francis.
Bye for now.